All right, so today is an unusual day, as we're not actually doing the office hour from an office. Instead, I am a guest of my esteemed multiple-time former colleague, Ian Afflerback. But it's a bit like an office hour because we did used to share an office.
That's right, Voorhees 344.
So, right.
Never forget.
Man, ducks in the walls.
Ducks in the walls.
That was it, right?
That's an insider joke. Yeah. There's maybe only 35 depressed graduate students in the country prepared to get that joke.
I'm Andrew Marzoni.
I'm Toby Wilson Bates.
I'm Nick Sturm.
And this is The Office Hour.
Sure. My name's Ian Afflerback. I'm an assistant professor of American literature at the University of North Georgia. Toby and I are trading gags about our time spent as graduate students at the University of California, Davis, where we were office mates and used to have these sorts of back and forth conversations long before we knew to call them podcast material.
Yeah. Then we realized.
Well, then you realized. You're the innovator.
It's true. I'm breaking new ground. So I wanted to talk to you today about a word that's been bugging me a bit. This is how I imagine that I'm being somehow efficacious in our new world in 2017, is to think about like the language that's circulating and then the sort of history of that language and how I think it problematically affects things like our understanding of conceptual history and that kind of stuff.
And you're right. I mean, for the record, you're right to do this. No one pays attention to words or why they matter. One could stop the sentence there, but especially right now, we're inattentive to where words come from and why they matter and how we use them and whether they're true or not.
Yeah. And I feel like part of the moment that we're in is This weirdness where people are trying to figure out what the word is to describe what's happening right now, and
yeah, right.
I see words get chosen, and when it's the wrong word, it really puzzles and concerns me, because I think that there's a danger to misidentifying the phenomena that are going on at the moment. Mm-hmm. And so the word in particular that I'm thinking of that's kind of bugging me this week is the word realpolitik, which I've seen deployed often in places like The New Yorker or The New York Times to describe the function of our current administration, often in the context of choosing a path that expresses power or contention or like tension or particular kinds of, I don't know, like ethnic competition, as opposed to what we might think of as like rational or scientifically grounded or governmentally sound things. And this word realpolitik is used. And I heard that I don't think that's what that means. Like, that just, you know, as a scholar of the 19th century and seeing that word employed some, and so I did a little bit of digging on this, and it looks like it was coined by this guy, Ludwig von Rochow?
Von Rochow, yeah. Sure. Yeah.
I'm going to make you read this. So in 1853, he writes the book,
Grundsätze der Realpolitik angewendet auf der städtlichen Zustände Deutschlands.
Yeah. Real page turner.
Yeah.
And my understanding of his basic thesis of this book is that the Enlightenment happens, you know, across a number of social phenomena, things like the French Revolution, understanding the kind of blossoming of science, rational thought, political science, you know, kind of like Hobbesian understandings of the polis and this kind of thing. And yet, the Enlightenment, nonetheless, when it becomes like interpreted into actual political action on the ground, doesn't come out looking necessarily rational, or it doesn't come out in this ideal form that it's imagined in. It's not, we're not living in a rational or kind of scientifically correct world, but there's a sort of nexus between Enlightenment idealism and the thing that actually happens. And he calls this realpolitik, this point of entry into existence.
Yeah, and to give him some credit and to distinguish this original usage of the word, the ideas of the Enlightenment and the early years of the state, the nation state, were very much bound up together. Remember that in Kant's answer to the question, what is Enlightenment, he ends effectively with a kind of paean to Frederick the Great. And the Prussian state is going to be the realization of what Kant thinks the Enlightenment is at an individual level. These things are all tied up together, at least in the early years. Later on, the ease with which people see the state as the fulfillment of the Enlightenment gets harder and harder to maintain.
Right. This was my idea, that maybe part of what's happening, because it doesn't strike me that when people look at the current administration, they're like, oh, well, like, they are agents of the Enlightenment, but when they actually become political actors, there is compromise in terms of how that's expressed politically with all the various sort of contending power centers and things like that. But rather, the question might be a little more basic, like, are we post-Enlightenment?
Oof, that's a giant question.
Yeah, don't worry, we have at least 15 minutes to answer it.
Are we post-Enlightenment? Adorno and Horkheimer would say both yes and no.
those dialectical jerks.
That's right. It's a pain, the dialectic. We've, on the one hand, watched Enlightenment take us places we didn't think it would go. If the state...
Like the moon.
Well, yeah, the moon. If we went there. I'm kidding. Don't buy the hype. If the state was supposed to be the fulfillment of the Enlightenment, for Adorno and Horkheimer, in the dialectic of Enlightenment, their point is the state leads eventually to the camps, to Nazi Germany, to a kind of intense nationalism that's far more destructive than it is enlightening. And yet, in the dialectic, antithesis to this point, for them, it's not abandoning Enlightenment, but fulfilling the promise of Enlightenment that will see people through. So the Enlightenment has devoured itself. It's re-enchanted the world. But the solution is more Enlightenment.
Oh, wow. So wait. So, and maybe this is me, kind of floundering around in my intellectual history a little bit. So the Enlightenment is sort of synonymous with the nation state?
Yeah. I think it's not coterminous. I mean, it begins with the scientific revolution and industrialism and any number of other things. The Enlightenment is hard to pin down to the birth of the state. But if we're talking political history and political categories, the state is the unit of measure that's supposed to finally lend order to the chaos of the political realm. When Hegel writes in the wake of Kant, he says that the only task of the state is to fulfill itself. I'm paraphrasing there. But there's the sense of which all the project of kind of philosophical idealism is going to be realized in the state.
Huh.
Now, part of the way that we might answer your question by being post-Enlightenment is, are we post-state? Right? Are we globalized? Are we so international that the nation state's just not the category that matters?
Yeah, I like that question. I mean, I don't know if I like that question. That's a terrifying question. No, but it's interesting to think about, when we talk about an election, for example, is it, increasingly a global phenomena? Like, are we more interested in, foreign players and a relationship to the global community than necessarily sort of, the national community when we think about, an object like an election?
And there are, from what I understand, I don't keep up with the literature, but there are still intense debates in international relations about this.
Hmm.
Can one be a political realist today? I think there's a neo-realist school. There's ongoing contention about whether you can stick to the, call it classical realism, that understands individual self-interest as culminating in the state.
Well, for me, realism is Madame Flaubert or whatever, Bovary.
Madame Flaubert,
killing it over here. Madame Bovary, buying six different colors of ink to write her love letters to have an affair. That's not the realism you're talking about.
No, I'm referring to a traditional distinction in political theory or international relations between political realism and political idealism. On the one hand, you have political realism, which says there's such a thing as human nature, and that human nature is basically self-interested. It concerns itself first and foremost with power. Eventually, the nation-state becomes the vehicle for that form of self-interest, the best way of channeling that through nationalism, for better and worse. On the other side, political idealism says politics should be about finding the right kind of political arrangement, an ideal form of justice or fairness, depending on your inclination, and building a state or an international community, because idealism very often transcends the state, that can be a kind of a fulfillment of the model for what right political life should look like.
Wow, why didn't we have this like conversation 2 years ago?
I don't know, man.
No, I mean, it's making me think about like the Democratic primary. You know,
ugh, do we have to revisit that? No, we don't have to. No.
But just in terms of like that was another hang-up I had, mm-hmm. like way back when, was like calling Hillary Clinton a pragmatist, where you're like, that doesn't seem right, but maybe if you're like, well, I think that like she's the kind of bureaucrat most capable of pulling the bureaucrat levers,
yeah.
whereas Bernie is imagining like an ideal form of government that I don't think would be translated into efficacy, then like that's where people were like imagining a kind of pragmatic choice as opposed to an ideal choice in that moment.
Interesting. I mean, the irony of this is that pragmatism is so often used as a term to slur whoever one doesn't like in a given moment. And I'll just point out that in the 1910s and 20s, it's the very first wave of quote-unquote American liberals, progressives writing for venues like The Atlantic, who are trying desperately to hold on to idealist notions about international community and America not intervening in global wars and so on, who are labeled pragmatists, in part because their actual affiliation with John Dewey and the school of people who invented the term pragmatism, but they're slurred on these grounds by people like Reinhold Niebuhr, who would be influential in making political realism a meaningful philosophy in American politics.
Wow. So I'm not going to just say wow the whole time. This is also how I am as a teacher. It's worth saying this. I'm teaching this research class now, and my students do all these like upper level like advanced research projects on, you know, like blockchains and gene modeling and, you know, like artificial intelligence and stuff. And like this is like every present. I'm like, wow, way to go! like more of like a little league soccer coach than a scholar.
Great swing.
Yeah, just so you know what I'm going for here. Ah, well, that makes me think that this real politics thing—it's more just like a recycling an old political movement in America without actually changing anything.
So here's my take on this. I think that what we mean when we say realpolitik is political realism. But by dressing it up in the Germanness of the word, we lend it a kind of substance that it doesn't always have. Now, that's not to say that political realism doesn't have substance. It's a rich, deep, provocative tradition. But I think when it's thrown as a word, realpolitik, to justify some of Trump's behaviors, it's trying to pretend that there's a school of thought behind a set of behaviors that don't have a school of thought behind them.
Yeah, that was my feeling. That like my sense of the current administration is that it's kind of a counterpunching body, like built more on sort of reacting in the moment based on like a kind of a quick, almost like kind of basic mathematical sense of like pluses and minuses, and not on like a coherent ideology or negotiation of a set of like idealist or realist philosophies.
Yeah, and I mean, I would be inclined to agree with you. Just to contrast that with, I mentioned Reinhold Niebuhr as a political philosopher who, for instance, Obama was on the record as saying was one of his biggest political influences. He was an advisor to the Kennedy White House. Niebuhr has a whole kind of invisible influence on American politics. So Niebuhr was a Protestant theologian from Detroit and a minister who then converted to being a kind of someone who converted political theoretical ideas to pop philosophy. That wasn't the term used back then,
right.
But he made them portable, he made them digestible, and built a huge national following, and years later was an advisor to presidents. But in essence, you can see in the title of Niebuhr's books, Moral Man, Immoral Society, you know, the basic idea that there's an individual good, human nature's okay, but when we band together and try to do things, there are fundamental problems. Power always gets involved. Mm-hmm. Greed gets involved. There's an irony of our best wishes leading to the worst possible outcomes. And that sooner or later, something like original sin manifests itself at a national level. No matter how pure and innocent the United States might be as a nation, despite trying to quote-unquote help the world year after year, we'll cause devastation and trouble and shucks golly be in charge of the world's atomic arsenal. So I'm being a little flippant.
But really depressing.
But, well, the irony of American history is an incredible read. Niebuhr was a brilliant writer, but you can feel how different that is than something like Trump's worldview.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not you agree with Niebuhr's intensely Protestant underpinnings for his political views, there's a real worldview in there. And it's just not clear that that's what's coming out of the kind of willy-nilly decisions by the current administration.
Man, that's really interesting. I'm always interested in this. Like, one, do you teach versions of this idea? And if you do, like, what's the story that you teach?
I don't very often get the chance to really get students to read the primary texts, to sit down and read
right.
Dewey versus Niebuhr.
Well, right? This is my shtick.
Yeah.
Like, so get ready. Here it
this
comes.
This is the one and only shtick.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. Amazing. I've had so many podcast episodes at this point. Basically, and this is like how I did my whole thing with like teaching artificial intelligence and always making my like robot engineer students read Frankenstein.
Robot engineers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Got it. that like actually like the sort of seed version of this entire discourse can be held inside of a story. You can put that story in your brain and it can germinate.
Yeah.
And be potentially really useful. And so this is to say, maybe they don't get to Dewey and Niebuhr, but like, is there like a big money excerpt or something
yeah.
that you give them that like gives them the sort of, yeah, I don't know, like molecular version of this story?
So here's a version, hard-boiled detective fiction. Hard-boiled detective fiction coming to fruition in the United States after the Depression is all about, is it acceptable to step outside of what we consider the law, standard, idealized, right practice, in order to have good effects? In other words, realism. If you want to catch the bad guy and restore safety, security to your neighborhood, whether that's the streets of Harlem in a Chester Himes novel or, you know, the international neighborhood of the Americas, is it acceptable to break the law? And that's what these novels continually stage as a kind of question. Now, I think it's interesting to note a classroom full of 18 or 20-year-olds today is really conflicted about that answer. Because there's a number who see the ends justifying the means. If you do a greater amount of good by this detective's actions, well, all right, he had to break the law a couple times, but so be it.
I was about to say, I mean, is this being litigated through like Deadpool and Batman right now? And Wolverine?
Well, that's interesting. You know, the problem that I have with the Avengers series, call it the Marvel Universe, I guess that's my technical terminology, right? Is that it allows people to break the rules, but then still end up on the morally right side of things.
Yeah.
It actually, for as much as people make Deadpool out to be an anti-hero, they mean that because he curses and he says naughty things.
Yeah, he does butt jokes.
Right. But in the end, he's both on the side of the good and the right.
Yeah.
You know, he both causes good things to happen, but he seems basically morally right the entire way through.
Yeah. I was pretty disappointed by that.
I mean, it was an enjoyable little movie. I'm not expecting Marvel to, like, solve the realism-idealism debate, but...
Get it together, Marvel.
Get it together, Marvel. But I think what's more impressive is a movie that can genuinely stimulate those kinds of questions. And I don't think that... I think superhero franchises are overwhelmingly about producing a kind of naive idealism. That there's simple good in the world and there's simple evil. Even if we don't recognize it at first, it can be confusing. But then ultimately we know the bad guys are really just Nazis. Yeah. And, you know, that simplifies everything.
Yeah, with like red skull faces. Or
yeah, it's the worst of all possible worlds.
Oh, man. Would you ever teach Candide? That's like one of my favorite books.
You know, I would love to teach Candide, but again, I have to design the class one day that'll just let me teach all this political theory and figure out how I can justify that class in an English department.
Okay, so I'm going to pitch a next crazy one at you.
Yeah.
Why not? Superhero movies, on top of failing to stage, like to use a kind of clumsy term for it, like the kind of ethical dilemma of like vigilante justice.
Yeah.
Is this like actually something that kind of destroys a public ability to have that conversation in a meaningful way? Like, it brings up the conversation and it's like, this isn't a real conversation. Like, come back next week for Spider-Man 8.
Yes. So this would be my hot take on the current illegibility of the realism versus idealism debate. The fact that you and I are talking about this, but most people aren't. And most people are throwing around real politics to describe Trump in a way that doesn't make sense. How is this all possible? So here's my hot take. I think for 20 to 30 years, we've been in a position where every politician has learned to speak the language of idealism, but follow the practices of realism.
Oh, that's good.
And that's completely confused anything like a meaningful distinction between these philosophies. Everyone learns to talk global equality and support and righteousness for the oppressed. We've all learned that this is what we have to say. And yet at the same time, the United States has been conducting military operations all around the world with nothing other than self-interest in mind, etc., etc., etc. It's very easy to see how we're self-interested as a nation and yet constantly preaching global democracy.
I like it.
Like it and don't like it.
No, I mean, it's horrible.
Right.
But it's 2017, so that's our baseline.
Yeah, we're post-horrible.
yeah, I think that was it. I think we solved it.
That was it? I don't know, that feels premature to me.
Have you listened to this podcast?
I mean, not really.
Thanks, Ian.
You're quite welcome, Toby.
The Office Hour is a production of the Britton Fellows in the Writing and Communication Program at Georgia Tech. For more information, visit us on the internet at textile.lmc.gatech.edu. Thanks for listening.